is Peggy Van Skoik. Today is Saturday, January 17th, 2009. I am at the Page Walker Hotel, and this evening we are having a Martin Luther King Jr. Dream Fest event for open to the public for the town. I am hoping to attract various visitors to the Page Walker into the music room here to do on-the-spot oral history interviews with them so they can tell me their stories having to do with civil rights and desegregating the schools. So we'll see what we get. Okay, so your name again?
It's Bruce Roberts.
Okay.
And I'm the photographer for the Just Yesterday book, the pictures that are hanging around here.
Yes, well, now tell me about your career again.
Well, I came to North Carolina 1955 to work for the Hamlet News Messenger as a photographer. It was probably one of the smallest papers in North Carolina. But I started there, and then a year or so later, I got an offer from the Charlotte Observer, and I went to Charlotte as a staff photographer for the paper there, and that's basically how I learned photography, was on-the-job training. Pete McKnight, the editor at the Charlotte Observer, hired really one of the great photo staffs, and we really learned from each other, and it was a very good experience. Every one of the photographers there, I guess there were six or seven, were all offered jobs at various magazines. They went to work for National Geographic, for Life, later for People magazine, and I went to Southern Living as the first director of photography and helped to start the magazine.
Wow, that's fantastic.
So, but the in the time period in the late 60s, I was freelancing for various New York magazines, Time, Life, did some Sports Illustrated assignments and so forth, but a lot of it was the civil rights activities in the South.
So were you mostly concentrated in North Carolina, or was it the whole South?
It was the whole South. I think the worst job that I got in that time period was I was assigned to photograph the George Wallace presidential campaign. And I didn't know it at the time, but Time really wasn't interested in many pictures of George Wallace's campaign. They wanted to have a photographer there in case he got shot.
Really?
And I took 10,000.
Were you there when he was shot?
No, I wasn't, because that happened about 2 years later after the campaign was over. So,
that's right.
I have 10,000 pictures of George Wallace campaigning, and it was like being between two sides. There was one side of the street would be his supporters, and on the other side would be all the anti-Wallace supporters, and you just hope that they didn't start fighting each other while you were there. It was really a pretty chaotic campaign. But about halfway through the campaign, he got Secret Service protection, and they got the thing organized, so you had some semblance of order. But I never got not a single one of my pictures was published.
Oh.
I think actually, the press paid for Wallace's plane. They sold tickets on the campaign plane for like $12,000 for the campaign. I mean, that's how much they wanted somebody there.
Wow.
So it was an interesting experience.
I bet. Yeah. So you were telling me how. Tell me the story about the pictures you took in Raleigh when there was a demonstration going on outside of what became the theater after the Civil War.
Oh, that was in Charlotte. Yeah, that
in Charlotte.
Yeah, that was interesting. That demonstration followed perhaps a week or two after the sit-ins that which simply closed the lunch counters for about a month, and then they worked out an agreement to reopen them. The next thing, and I guess the last really visible sign in downtown Charlotte of integration, of segregation, was the fact that the theaters downtown, the blacks had to sit upstairs and the whites had to sit downstairs. So the demonstrators had signs saying that they wanted to be treated equally, and they were going back, and I guess about 20 of them, in front of the theater. Well, the theater building was one of the older buildings on Tryon Street, Charlotte, and at one time, back in 1864, apparently had been a bank building, and it was the place that the last meeting of the Confederate cabinet was held. As you know, the cabinet, you know, left Richmond, finally got down to Charlotte, and that was when the final surrender for Joe Johnson was authorized and the last business. And the interesting thing about that particular spot was when Jefferson Davis came out of the building at the end of the meeting, he was greeted by a dispatch rider who told him that Lincoln had been assassinated. And so that spot was marked with a kind of a bronze plaque embedded in the concrete sidewalk. And here were these demonstrators just a few feet away, and there were some white teenagers who were kind of heckling the demonstrators and throwing pennies at them. And it was interesting to see the pennies roll around by the feet, and Lincoln's face was all over the place, and I thought, well, that's kind of the alpha and omega of things. I don't think that picture ever got published but it was just a personal experience for me to see that. And when I walked back to the Charlotte Observer, I passed Pound and Moore, the office supply store, and I went in to see if they were still selling white and colored signs for bathrooms. And they had one set left.
Wow.
And I bought it.
Did you?
Yeah, and if you want to see it, it's now in the Charlotte Museum.
So they sold those signs as a set in office supply?
Yes.
Stores? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, I grew up in New York, and so I guess I had not realized how quiet segregation was when I first came down here. Susie Tilt is the same, had the same experience, even though she was born in the South. She said that she never really thought about it until the demonstrations came, and I think many of us were that way.
Mm-hmm.
And when I moved to Birmingham, it really there was such a difference between North Carolina and Alabama in that the old South was still there in Alabama, whereas North Carolina just had a different feel about it. And a large part of that, I think, is that it was small farms and not the big plantations and so forth.
And what was the expression you told me a while ago about North Carolina?
Oh, yeah. Well, North Carolina, I was told when I came here, was a valley of humility between two mountains of conceit, Virginia and South Carolina.
That's great.
when I got to Alabama, John Logue, who was editor at Southern Living, said, now, he said, there's one thing I got to tell you. He said, football is not a matter of life and death down here, although you may think otherwise, but it really is far more important. Of course, those were Bear Bryant days.
Yeah.
But,
Now, you were telling me you were sent to cover the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had an assignment from Life. Life was interested in doing a Klan story, and they had done considerable research on where the best costumed Klan people could be found. and it turned out it was a Klan in Natchez, a very famous tourist town. And I met a reporter from Life at the New Orleans airport. We drove up, and we were both a little nervous about this. But anyway, the Klan took us out in the woods, and they had, this was the only mounted Klan outfit in America.
So they were on horseback.
Yeah, they were on horseback, and they had beautiful robes. They had the red robe, and they had the a green robe for the Grand Dragon. The red robe was for the minister.
And the rest were white.
The rest were white. You know,
the working Klan.
Going to a Klan rally, you always have prayers, and you really, it really is amazing how religion gets mixed into that. But
now you were telling me that in Mississippi, it was the only state where it was legal to cover their faces.
Yeah, progress was being made in the 60s, and most states had passed laws that the Klan could not wear face masks.
Couldn't cover their
faces. Yeah, couldn't cover their faces. For programs, whatever. But in Mississippi, they could. And so we saw the horsemen come, and it was really a spectacular shot. It was springtime, and the green of the trees were just coming out. You had these wonderful green and red and white robes, and I knew that I had the cover on. So that I shot everything vertical, and it was just the most perfect cover. And we got the film back to the airport and shipped up to New York, and I was just sure I had the cover. But for the first time ever, Life sold a fold-out ad, so it turned the cover into a horizontal format, and all my pictures were vertical. So they decided they would move this wonderful picture to the opening of the news section. And back in 65, Life was about half printed in black and white and half in color. And that first page was a black and white page. So all the picture appeared in Life as a black and white picture.
Aww.
opening the story.
You must have been very disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah, to say the least.
Yeah, that was the only chance I had for a Life cover, and I blew it by not doing a horizontal.
Oh, boy. Oh, yeah. That's sad. Well, have you done anything with that picture since? Is it in a museum somewhere? Or?
Oh, it's been in some books.
Good, yeah. good. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
In color, I hope.
In color, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. The thing I remember most about a Klan meeting in North Carolina in Salisbury was that the textile mills were beginning to be integrated. And so the whole pitch, the Klan was always trying to take advantage of any opportunity for members, because that meant money. And so they were saying, well, if you join the Klan, we'll stop the textile mills from being integrated. It was a...
Were they successful at doing that in some cases?
I don't think so. I think they would promise anything
To get members.
To get members, yeah. Yeah.
So that was happening in Salisbury, throughout the Piedmont and all the mills that were going there.
Yeah, but the best story about the Klan rally was a few years earlier when I was down in Maxton near Hamlet, and the Klan decided that they would burn a cross in front of an Indian home. They're Lumbee Indians in down that way. And the Lumbee Indians, I think, are a mixture of Indians and the Lost Colony. And because some of the same names appear in the Lumbee Indians tribe. Well, the Lumbees didn't like the idea of the Klan coming down there. So Catfish Cole was the Grand Dragon at the time, and he had a field outside of Maxton and had his everybody there. And they had a loudspeaker, and they had a 100-watt light bulb over the platform from a generator. And but the Lumbees were in the woods around there, and they had worked out an agreement with the sheriff where they could, if they wouldn't aim low and hit the Klan, they could shoot in the air. And so when the Grand Dragon started to talk, the first shot hit the light bulb and plunged the clan into darkness. Then all around in the woods you could hear the gunshots. And the clansmen threw off their robes and fled. And the story goes that the Grand Dragon had to pay a black man to drive him out of the area in his car for $10.
That's great.
And I thought, you know, I really wish that the Lumbee Indians would get tribal status. I mean, they stood up to the Klan, but they made the Klan, the one thing the Klan could not stand was to be laughed at. And so the Lumbee Indians picked up the Klan robes, and a bunch of them drove up to the Charlotte Observer and burst into the newsroom. It just about frightened everybody. But Maury Rosen, who was the only photographer left in Charlotte, because everybody else was down trying to photograph the rally, got the picture that ran in life of the Indians dressed up in the Klan robes. And he shot it from the back so you could see the cross and all that stuff. And the Indians were just turning around, smiling at the camera. And it became kind of an icon of absolute humiliation to the Klan. And that's what everybody wanted. And the Klan never really recovered from that effect.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, they got laughed out of eastern North Carolina. So
now, where exactly was this the rally? It was in the woods
near Maxton, North Carolina.
Near Maxton?
Maxton.
Maxton, okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great story. That's really a great story. Do you know of much activity that was going on in Raleigh itself, or demonstrations, or riots, or anything like that?
No, because I was living in Charlotte, and,
okay.
And you know, we were dealing. There was activity in South Carolina, and then we were pretty wrapped up in the school integration. But
nothing comes to mind of Raleigh itself.
No.
No? Pretty quiet here?
Yeah, I think so. I think Greensboro probably was had the more violent things.
So, along with the Woolworth lunch counter sit-in in Greensboro, there were other things in Greensboro as well?
Yeah, there was a confrontation, which I think someone was actually killed.
Whoa.
In Greensboro. After the sit-ins and the theaters were open, Charlotte had a reputation for being a very, very moderate and pro sensible course. South Carolina, of course, had the big fight over the Confederate flag on the Capitol. And so
they're still fighting that one. So there was the Greensboro sit-in, and then you were telling me that the next day there was the one in Charlotte happened.
Nothing really happened except it was the end of integrated lunch counters.
So it worked.
It worked, yeah. And it was probably the most successful in the sense that there was no violence, and it did not get headlines, but it brought about the result that everybody wanted.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So the store closed down, all the stores closed down their lunch counters for about a month, you said?
Yeah, it was a few weeks or a month, and then they quietly reopened them and served everybody.
But they were now integrated.
Yes.
When they reopened them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was about a month later that the theaters ended up becoming
integrated
as well.
Too.
Did they have to close those down for a time before
they just quietly did it.
Did away with it.
Yeah. The other change really was that all the segregated bathroom signs disappeared.
Just quietly started disappearing.
Yeah. You know, one of the pictures of mine that got used a lot, it ran a double page in a book on the South that Life published, was a picture of a bathroom in South Carolina in which you had three doors, and one said men, ladies, and colored. And that was so common back then.
So the colored bathrooms were unisex?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But it was, you know, rather than gentlemen and ladies, or men and women, it always seemed to read men, ladies, and colored.
Colored.
Yeah. Kind of a...
Mm.
Yeah.
What about signs over the water fountains? Just whites and colors, or...
Yeah, well, they'd usually be in different locations, too.
Okay.
Yeah. But, yeah, you know, you didn't think about it when... At least I didn't when I first came down. You know, it was just kind of accepted.
It's the way it had always been, and nobody questioned it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
But you were watching it change right before your eyes, right in front of your camera.
Yeah. I always thought the Lummi Indians should have a some kind of remembrance for what they did, because
that took courage.
Yeah, it really did, and it was a the absolute humiliation of the Klan was really when things changed in the eastern part of the state. That's
So do you remember, or were you aware of the big billboard out on the highway going into, was it Zebulon or Wendell? Up until maybe the early 90s, that said home of the Ku Klux Klan.
No, but there was a sign on the South Carolina line that says the KKK welcomes you to South Carolina.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Scary stuff.
Yeah.
So you took a lot of pictures throughout the South, throughout the whole civil rights movement, from all over the South, and...
Yeah, mostly Mississippi and South Carolina, North Carolina. There was a... You know, I remember when they started integrating the schools, and particularly in South Carolina, a lot of the towns started private schools for the white kids, and the blacks got the old white schools. It was kind of a strange time. Yeah. But fortunately, we've gone beyond that.
Yeah, definitely. So when that was going on, then the white students who couldn't afford private school, what did they do? Did they end up having to attend the integrated public schools with mostly black children? Or?
Well, in the smaller places, I think there were some special arrangements made so that all the whites could go together in their own schools.
So they financially helped each other out.
Yeah. But what was so strange, you know, originally it had been separate but equal ruling in the Supreme Court, and I thought, you know, but what really has happened is that the blacks have gotten the good equipment and the good schools, and the whites are now, the blacks were,
right,
out of their own choice.
Yes. Well, these are great stories. Thank you so much.
Well,
I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Okay. 3 minutes,
just as long as you've got. Yeah, so would you tell me your name?
My name is Charlene Robinson.
Okay, hi, Charlene. Well, now, what story do you have to tell me about civil rights?
I have a story to tell about civil rights. I grew up in New York, Syracuse, New York, upstate area, and my parents kind of moved there to get away from the South. But during those times in the 60s, we... our school had to be relocated. We were reassigned, basically. We were reassigned to go to a beautiful new school that was built way outside of the city. And so we went. The first day, we pulled up in the buses, and they were throwing eggs at our buses, and I mean, I just couldn't believe it. We had to be escorted off the buses, and for several weeks, and I'm thinking, I'm in New York, I'm not in the South, you know, so this went on for a while, but they accepted that we were there to stay, but they still weren't our friends yet, you know. After that, I was in the ninth grade at that time, and my sister and brother was in school as well. We were all in the same school. My older sister was in the 12th grade. My brother was in the 11th grade. As they graduated out, I was in the 10th grade, and I remember going to my counselor. And I said, I wanted to go to college, and I want to take college prep courses. Well, she told me, well, your brother and sister didn't go to college, so I don't think that you're going to be going to college. I think it would be better for you to stay in the business area so that you can become a secretary or a bookkeeper because you're good at record keeping. Well, I thought that was kind of harsh and, you know, not what I wanted to do with my life. So then I went to the office. I talked to other counselors, other teachers, and they told me she was my counselor, so I had to deal with her. Well, I went home and I talked with my parents, and my dad said, well, you know, she's probably right because I don't have money to pay. I couldn't help your brother get into school. I said, but at this time, there were do you remember the EOC program, Equal Opportunity Grants that came out? And we were starting to be able to get those grants and go to college. At that time, they were coming out. So I told him that, and he says, well, I don't have money to pay, so, you know, if you can get a grant. My mom said, your teacher's probably right because you're going to find you a nice husband and you're going to raise children. You know, my mom's a real Southerner. But to make a long story short, I just thank God that I went through high school and I wasn't able to take the college prep courses, and so I tried to get in the back door of Syracuse University, and they told me because I hadn't prepared for college that it was going to, you know, I'd have to go through some courses for about 2 years, and then so I went to technical school. And I went to technical school, and I graduated from there in about a year, and I became a mainframe operator. You know, the big mainframes, right? And I've had an IT career ever since. So I am thankful that I was able to get a career, even though, you know, I was held back, you know, because of racial issues. And in the end, God called me into college, and when he sent me to college, I went for biblical studies, so I do have a degree in Christian ministry.
Well, that's great. Now, where did you get your degree?
And I got my degree from More Than Conquerors College in Charlotte, North Carolina.
So you had to come south to be able to go to college.
But I say, yes, we can.
You know it.
And by the power of the Holy Spirit, we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us.
Absolutely.
Yes, we can. So I don't hold any grudges. You know, I just look at it as an experience and as my cross to bear. And, you know, my life is full now.
That's fabulous.
Thank you so much.
That was... Okay, so first of all, just tell me your name.
Mary Shelton.
Mary, okay. Mary, what story do you have to tell me about civil rights?
It is about civil rights in a way. My mom is black and my father's white, and they were born here in North Carolina. They were not allowed to get married here, and so they moved to Michigan when both sets of parents died on both sides because they wouldn't get permission. They met at the only school for the deaf, at the Governor Moorhead School. They stayed there 9 months out of the year, and then they went back to their prospective farms 3 months a year. So they didn't get married till they were in their 30s. They were married 61 years. My mom is still alive. She's 95. And my dad passed away in 98 at age 88. And where I buried him in Colfax, North Carolina. He's buried next to his mom and dad in a private cemetery. And even though they lived all these years married, they said, his family says she cannot be buried next to him. So, and that was in 1998. So it really does my heart good to know that we elected a black president. So after all these years, there are, you know, some progress. And that's a huge step, I think.
You know it.
It is a huge, huge step. So I'm really, really pleased about that. Yeah. Really, really pleased.
So now your folks, you said, were at the School for the Deaf? Mm-hmm.
They're both deaf and mute.
Oh, they both were?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Now, how did they meet?
At the School for the Deaf.
Oh, that's where they met?
Yeah.
They, oh, okay.
There was only one, and it was not segregated. So
okay.
They had only one school, and they stayed there 9 months out of the year.
Oh,
and
I see.
And then 3 months, they went back to their prospective farms. My father was from Colfax, and my mother was from Williamston.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah, they waited till both sets of parents died, got married in Michigan, and were married 61 years.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Now, what did they do for a living?
My mom didn't work. She was a housewife, and my dad made ball bearings for cars.
Oh.
Yes, but what he learned here was being a carpenter, and he built his own home when he was 65.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was just amazing that he could remember all those carpentry skills from North Carolina. And I ended up here. Yeah, I ended up here even though I was born in Michigan. I lived in California, and then now I live here.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes, it is. So, yes, it is great. It is great.
Oh, that's great. What a yeah. great story.
Yeah, it
that's
is a great story.
Great.
It
well,
is.
Thank you.
You're
thank
welcome.
You
thank you.
And tell me how we do this. Do you ask any questions, or do I just start telling you my story?
You can first tell me your name.
Okay.
And then just start telling me your story.
Okay. When will you start recording?
I am right now.
Okay. My name is Bob Pierce. I'm a resident of Cary, North Carolina. I will be 70 years old and this year, and have a diverse background and have lived in many, many places, including abroad in lots of countries around the world, and as well as in the United States. I've been fortunately fairly well educated, and I can tell you honestly that I came from very austere beginnings. Very, very poor family. Dad died when I was a little boy, and my mom, who was poorly educated and had medical problems, and basically drug us around, my sister and I, around the country. And because of that, I ended up spending a good bit of my youth in Newark, New Jersey. And for those of you who might not know, Newark has always been a very, very tough city. Very, very tough. Like a Detroit, or like an LA, or like a Chicago, with lots of gangs. And back in the 40s, there was no such thing as separate schools. The realities were that everything was integrated. So the only thing that was separate was neighborhoods. So you might have a black neighborhood within the city, or you might have a Chinese neighborhood in the city, or an Italian one in the city. But when you all got to school, right, everybody was in school together, and you had a playground, and everybody played together. And it was not uncommon to call each other names. And Chinese kids were called chinks, and Puerto Rican kids were called spics, and Italian kids were called wops, and so on. But there was no hatred when you spoke the name. It was more of a group identity. And when you said, yo, Spicks, you want to play today? You want to go play wall ball? You want to play stick ball? You know, and somebody else would laugh and say, yeah, yeah, man, do so-and-so. It was rare that you had any kind of real confrontations except person to person. So what I experienced when I grew up in that environment was a perception of pretty much equality, of pretty much acceptance. Pretty much not hatred, but you got along because you went to school together and you played together, and that's just how it was. Now, having the good fortune to be plucked out of that city environment and shipped upstate New York to go board with some people when I was becoming a hoodlum right down in Newark, I got exposed to more middle America values up in upstate New York. And again, there was really no racism or bigotry and those kinds of things. And having graduated from that high school environment, I went up to a college environment, which again was without racism and so on. I entered the Air Force in 1962, and my first assignment as a young lieutenant was Biloxi, Mississippi. And for the first time in my life, I came to understand what true racism was all about and what true bigotry was all about. And having the opportunity to see with my own eyes billboards that said, "Nigger, if you find yourself in this town after sundown, you're going to be dead." And actually having signs of that nature on billboards and actually walking into a public facility and having a black entrance and a white entrance and having doctors who wouldn't see black people and the use of the N-word rampant. To give you a little idea about the naivety of the Northeasterner, my young wife at the time came down with me and we were in temporary quarters and had to do some laundry. And so we pulled up in front of the laundromat, and I had a little baby, and so I was going to keep the baby, and my wife went in to do the laundry. And she took all our clothes. And in a very short time, she came back out. And I said, "Honey, what's the matter?" And she said, "Well, we can't do our laundry here." And I said, "What do you mean we can't do our laundry here?" She said, "Well, I brought all the clothes." I said, "What do you mean you brought all the clothes?" She said, I bought the white clothes, I bought the colored clothes, and there's a big sign in there, and it says, "No colored." It says, "No colored. You can't do colored clothes in there." And I tell you this little story to let you get a feel for how innocent and how naive the typical person from the Northeast was about what the real conditions were in the South. And so, in my tour of duty at Biloxi, Keesler Air Force Base, young black officers who were assigned were not permitted to live off the base because it was too dangerous. And there were incidences in the paper every day that were absolutely absurd. Stories about how black people had done so-and-so and were tried and were convicted in a matter of hours. Stories about hangings, and the KKK was still active in the adjoining states as well as Mississippi. Well, that was the big eye-opener, obviously, and then the good news was that within the ranks of the military, truly an organization that was without prejudice by regulation. I don't care who the person was or where they came from, once you got in the military, you were not allowed to in any way, shape, or form practice prejudice or show prejudicial behavior or racist behavior subject to court-martial. You were not allowed to do this. Now, that doesn't mean that some didn't exist, and we all know that, but it was certainly behind the scenes and nothing that was in the open. And the good news, additionally, was that a black person really did have recourse in the military. They have something called the Inspector General Office. And if a black person really had bad treatment, he had a way with impunity to go complain to the IG, and the IG would investigate. And even in Mississippi, that gave a young black person a chance to be heard as opposed to be hung, shot, killed, or whatever.
Even in 1962?
Even in 1962.
Wow.
So throughout my military career, it was just routine and accepted that prejudice was just not allowed, and I never saw that. And black officers got promoted right along with white, all depending upon experience, education, talent, ability, and so on, and truly a merit system, and you got promoted if you did your job the best that you could. Now, having said all that and gone into other careers after I retired from the military and industry, once again, I got into a situation where I didn't see very much of it. And then I had the occasion to come to Cary, North Carolina. And this was in about the 1985 time frame. And once again, I had my eyes blown wide open and my heart broken, because having thought that I was now in a northern state, more or less, even though it's a Carolina, thinking that I was beyond all that, come to find out that in 1986 or 7, I'm not quite sure which year, I came to find out that the Crowsdale Country Club over in Durham was an all-white organization. And until that year, until 1987, no black person had ever been allowed to be a member at Crosdale. But only through some political campaigning, through some community pressures, was a black person actually allowed to be a member of a country club in North Carolina.
Wow.
And having said all that, that's probably enough of my little story to illustrate the wide range of things that I experienced over my life. And I would like to conclude my remarks by just saying that sitting here in the Page Walker, participating in a Martin Luther King celebration, where we just had a beautiful entertainment, entertainer, sing us a song about meeting each other halfway and living our lives together. I am hoping and praying that we will have initiatives in the future that focus on Americanism. Americanism, what it takes to be a great American. I have had it up to my eyebrows with racists, with separatists, with somebody who thinks their gang is better than your gang and all that kind of stuff. And I'm hoping with our new president that that will become a reality, a true reality, and Americanism will prevail. And thank you for letting me talk with you.
Well, thank you. That was fabulous.
Well, thank you.